Hey everybody, Andrew Farmer here, host of Hey Kids Comics. Just a special upfront note about this issue. This issue is about monsters and comic books. We've been wanting to do it for a while. We were blessed to have Michael Price with us. Michael Price, comic historian, podcaster, writer, comic creator, all around amazing guy with an amazing intellect. As we usually do, we have a warm-up before the show, and then we get started. This episode, it was too good to cut. The content was too good. Michael is too on point, too genius to even remove even a little bit of what we were going to talk about. So we just ran with it. This is just up front. You'll hear it in the show. But thank you for joining us for this issue, and have a spooky Halloween. Podcast and not just interviewing Michael Price right now. Like, for real. Like, I'm not even kidding. Like, I'm just going to sit wrapped in silence for the next hour.
Exactly.
Well, just jump in on whatever you got to discuss. I think was the topic to be horror in the comic books.
That's right.
Something about monsters and comics.
All right.
Parallels there. Tremendous parallels when the... When the Comics Code put the horror comics out of business in 1954, right about then was where the movies picked up where the comics had left off. So the parallels are amazing.
Oh my, that's something I wouldn't have even thought about, how that happened.
That corollary.
Pent up demand. Well, these comic books are turning our children into monsters, so we better get rid of them. Kids want to be shocked and scared and amused.
Right.
And of course, you read Tales from the Crypt, they're about half humor and half horror mixed
That's
together.
So true. I actually had some old pre-code horror that I stumbled on somewhere as a kid, and there was so much that was just kind of quirky, fun stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm paying very close attention to the numerous reprint volumes right now, because I've got a hand in those myself, and you got to see what the competition's doing.
Right.
That's so true.
And there's a lot of crossover. Craig Yeoh and I just finished a book called The Ghosts and Girls of Fiction House. Fiction House was a prominent publisher in the 40s, started out in pulp fiction and branched into comics with the the tail end of the Depression years. And my gosh, it was like a trampoline rebounding 10 years later to Tales from the Crypt. Same talents in many cases.
Guys, here's what I'm going to do. This is all, from about 5 minutes ago on, it's way too good to cut. I'm not going to cut it. That's all really good.
We'll just have a preamble to the show.
We'll record a preamble. I'm going to jump right in. I'm Andrew Farmer, host of Hey Kids Comics. With me, as always, is the Jedi Cole Houston. The other voice that you're hearing right now is Michael Price, whom was put on this earth for two reasons. To be amazing and to make Cole and I just sit and listen, because that's what we've been doing, and it's astounding. Michael, thank you for joining us tonight.
Delighted.
I'm going to throw it now to Cole to explain what we're doing and everything that's going on. This is one of those shows I just want to sit and listen. That's what I really want to do. I know I'm the host, but God.
Yes, indeed. The idea here came to me well over a year ago, is that we needed to do a show about monsters in comics. That is, both monster comics, like those wonderful Lee and Kirby, where Stan Lee would just create a word by stringing a bunch of vowels and consonants together, and Jack Kirby would turn them into some of the most amazing. I can't even begin to fathom the process of how you get this kind of amazing out of these words. But
Kirby had the bigger ideas, of course, but he and Stan made a pretty good team while they lasted.
That is so true, and it was just almost like every single creature fit the name. That actually looks like a Bordoon or whatever. That's what I would name it if had the process been reversed.
Yeah, my favorite was Goom.
Goom.
That is until his son Googam showed up.
I know Googam. I've seen that.
So they were doing sequelized continuity even in those days before the eruption of Marvel Comics as a cultural force.
That is amazing. So, and I knew when we were speaking tonight, we were like, oh, I hope it's very last minute. I want to point out, Michael, that we brought Michael in extremely last minute. We suddenly were like, why don't we see if we can get a guest? I thought, I know just the person, but it is a huge long shot because it's just literally right now we need to know. And so, again, thank you very much for being on.
Well, yeah, you caught me at an opportune time, just finishing up a new the master disc for the new CD, and beginning to think, okay, what else needs doing? I've got some idle time here. This is good. This is a good way to spend it.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you for spending your free time with us tonight. That's very much.
Certainly, in addition to Goom and Googam, we also wanted to talk a lot, and I think that, again, this is where Michael's going, and this will be very much in your wheelhouse as well, the classic monsters as they became part of the comic culture, often turned into superheroes or
right.
some bizarre facsimile thereof.
So mm-hmm.
There is much to talk about.
My thing about let's just call them what they were, because this is when they were really brought into our zeitgeist. You know, as a 38-year-old man, my zeitgeist for monsters began with the Universal monsters. It began with a Dracula, with a werewolf, with a Frankenstein.
Sure.
And mm-hmm. and what comics, and the reason that I love comics, and the reason that we do this show is because, and I've said many, many times, that done correctly, comic books are the best form of narrative art that you can possibly get your hands on. Because you can
many different genres and idioms have proven themselves adaptable to comics. And without dumbing down, if you go back and look at fellows like Steve Bissett, Alan Moore, Will Eisner, for Pete's sake, and dear old Harvey Pekar, bless him.
Oh, yes.
So where does that fall into, you know, when we start talking about the like you were saying before, the comic code, the paradigm shift that happened when they decided, when the decision was made that you could no longer have, quote-unquote, horror comics. Now, yeah, we all know that. But when that happened, did we see a shift from raw horror, you know, the EC, fantasizing and putting into a heroic context the monsters that we saw prior to that?
Oh, the more visceral shock value vanished almost overnight. Not without a fight. The kingpin of the horror comics turned out to be the Gaines Company's EC Comics.
Okay.
Tales from the Crypt, etc. And, of course, they were very vulnerable to social reformers who, we all know the story of Dr. Frederick Wortham and his bogus research that, quote-unquote, proved the harmful influence of comics.
Oh, and in fact, it was funny. I was thinking of Seduction of the Innocent recently and seeing, and I cannot for the life of me recall what it was, but someone was trying to draw an equal kind of corollary between one thing and another, and I thought, I wonder if they just went and, you know, interviewed a bunch of juvenile delinquents and with leading questions and arrived at the same sort of conclusions that Wortham
did. That's a fairly concise description. A lot of Wortham's so-called research proves to have been skewed, tilted, faked, and of course he dealt with troubled inner-city youth as a working psychiatrist, and he smelled a bandwagon. He
yeah.
was a grandstander, and did some maybe not irreparable harm, but certainly lasting harm, and the effects are still felt today. The funny thing about comic books, as they originated, that is, original material for comic books, as they originated in the late Depression years, they were, from the beginning, attuned to classical horror.
Right.
That's why you had like the Boris Karloff surrogate show up in a Captain America story during World War II. And it's like, gosh, this is or the vampire Nazis.
Yep.
Or, yes, natural
Nazis.
You know, I mean, Dick Briefer, the great, very versatile cartoonist, Dick Briefer, long before his famous run of Frankenstein comic books, half funny stuff and half scary stuff that by divisions, quite a bit before he started the Frankenstein series, he was adapting The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Wow.
That would be around, I would say, about 1938, roughly at a time when Bob Kane, before Batman, was still drawing funny animal comics.
So very true.
Let's be honest. Bob Kane continued to draw funny animal comics for about a year into Batman. Let's just
that's a complex heritage in itself.
It's also interesting the mention of the Nazi vampires. It seemed like almost a no-brainer that if you have something, you know, a society that you can classify as evil. Naturally, they're just making them even more evil.
Well,
only the vampires, they're Nazi vampires.
But there's a subtext there, too, because it's not even that they're evil. It's that it's an insidious evil that you can that you can inflict on someone else and make them that thing. So vampires make their own. So if you're a Nazi vampire, when you go in and you occupy, what are you doing? Right, you're absorbing them into the mass. So
you're converting and sublimating the dominated culture to a point where it either conforms or croaks.
Exactly. So even on a cellular level, it works. Like that.
It also came from the old adage: "You can't go to Transylvania and not see vampires." Somebody said, "Nazi vampire."
Oh man!
Nazi, exactly. Wonderful wordplay.
Welcome to the show,
and
Michael.
Of course, it helps to remember that the young people, mostly young guys, but with women involved to an extent in the creative chores, usually as inkers, colorists, background artists, writers, the comic book industry is a Jewish invention.
Right, right.
And boy, did they ever smell a rat in that Fortress Europa business.
Oh, yes.
I mean, even, you know, well, for example, Kirby was having... Joe Simon and Jack Kirby were having Captain America invade Fortress Europa before the United States entered World War II.
Wow. I did not know that.
And this at a time when the motion picture industry was discouraging any Hollywood studio from making films critical of the Third Reich.
Yeah, there was a tremendous amount of misinterpretation or just blind, you know, turning a very blind eye during that period. And so it is the unlikely media that come and act, you know, they're like the jester who can stand before the king and point out the grim truths, because they're not taken entirely seriously, even in the most serious of veins.
Oh, no, that's just kid stuff, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And but those kid stuff funny books were selling in the millions of copies, largely thanks to those nice Jewish boys Siegel and Shuster and their fellow Superman, and so on and so forth. You know, Bill Kane and Bob Kane and Bill Finger had so much debt to Superman when they began this Batman project. that they didn't even recognize their debt. And sure enough, didn't come to Siegel and Schuster's aid when the publishing company was getting ready to buy them out for chump change.
Yes.
Kane maintained a piece of the Batman action.
Okay.
That's a very strange every man for himself type attitude.
That occurred to me that there's oftentimes a bit of a propriety to when you recognize what you ought to be doing, you know, what's in your best interest.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily share that with everyone else for their best interest.
Right.
Well, no, I mean, self-sufficiency is a wonderful thing, but only if it is shared with people who have other self-sufficiencies.
Precisely.
And, Siegel and Schuster were operating a Commonwealth studio for the most part when Superman took off. And they hired assistants and ghosts. And from all accounts I've managed to turn up, Siegel and Schuster treated their ghosts fairly.
Okay.
They were not in turn treated very fairly by what became DC Comics. On the other hand, Kane feigning solo auteurship managed to strike a deal where he retained a piece of Batman.
Uh-huh.
And that's why you see rather garish Bob Kane signatures on a lot of stuff that you know he didn't draw.
But if you pass it over to his table, he'll be happy to put his name on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was about the same time that the beginnings of what we'd consider prototypical horror comics originated with the studio founded by Will Eisner and Jerry Iger. And Eisner has described it quite vividly, his operation, as a sweatshop, you know, like a Roman galley ship. And he also had the good sense to get out of that sweatshop atmosphere.
Yeah.
In order to develop a rather unpretentious little feature called The Spirit that turned into something really lasting. And Jerry Iger kept the shop going into the, I think Iger finally gave up the ghost about 1957.
Wow.
And into advertising. Jerry Iger used to show up at the Dallas Comics Conventions well into advanced age, and he was a delightful guy. He spoke very frankly of paying these cats $10 a page to do artwork that ranged from real art to amiable hack work.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, you very seldom see a signature on an Iger shop story. But if you learn to recognize styles, you can see the signature.
That's interesting because, and that's one of those things that a lot of people don't think about in any number of entertainment industries, is what a virtual sweatshop factory, like cartoon studios were often like that as well. Where
the Fleischer shop.
Stuff.
The Fleischer animation shop, Disney to an extent.
Yeah, early Disney.
The only time a woman had a chance to advance in the Disney animation factory was when the men all got drafted.
Oh.
So it became a studio of their own.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And of course, the history of the popular culture is quite literally a history of oppressed social and ethnic groups creating something of their own that becomes a force. Neil Gabler wrote a wonderful book about a generation ago called An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood.
Interesting.
And you see that happening when Tim Truman and I were developing the Prowler for Eclipse Comics about 87. We took it upon ourselves to make the title character a Jewish guy.
Okay.
Who has tried to assimilate into Wall Street, gets burned in the crash.
Okay,
sees evidence of the Wall Street predators and their manufacturing allies, and says, "Okay, I'm going to be the prowler from here on out." And he starts out as basically a unionist vigilante.
That's pretty amazing.
Okay. backstory is always fascinating. And of course we brought a lot of that out in the stories that Tim Truman and John Snyder and Graham Nolan and I did for the Prowler series.
How many issues did that run?
Ran about, let's see, I think we got 10 issues out before the big independent implosion. What, 1989, 90? Bandwagon gets rolling, and then everybody wants to get aboard, and then turns out they're too many for one bandwagon, and so things tend to collapse. But, we had some good years. Had the Airboy franchise, the Prowler, really nice, kind of a riff on Captain America called Sergeant Strike.
Remember Sergeant Strike?
Oh yeah.
I was collecting Airboy during the early part of its run as well.
Well, we're just now getting the complete revived Airboy out in nice new editions from IDW. And then Truman and Snyder and I are working on the Prowler reprints right now.
Excellent. So, that is amazing.
There's always something. Dave Schreiner used to be my editor at Kitchen Sink Press. Said, "Man, there's nothing keener than finding new things out about old things."
It's very true. That is absolutely accurate. Back to what we were talking about with Finger and Kane and Batman, as well as the Spirit. It strikes me that a lot of these early, and even it's not just early, but it continues. A lot of the hero books borrowed very heavily from especially Batman. I mean, we can't go through an episode of an issue of Hey Kids Comics without talking about Batman. But
it's meal.
But or Watchmen. I'm sure we'll get to Watchmen. They borrow very heavily from the mythos, the gothic nature of horror comics, especially Batman. Like, do you think that's just adolescent, you know, target audience, adolescent boy mass appeal, or is there more to that kind of that cyclical hero's journey that has been told forever that speaks to, you know, because you get your Persian tales and they're definitely could be construed as gothic horror type tales with monsters and overcoming and fighting and sometimes running away.
And the costumed masked adventurer tradition, you know, and there's a lot of Zorro in Batman.
That's
a lot
true.
Of the Scarlet Pimpernel. The Da Vinci flying devices.
So true.
The fantasy of giving a man wings. Or
right.
A cape in this instance. Certainly a Broadway play called The Bat, which dates from the 20s, filmed in 1926 and then remade as a movie in 1931, I believe. And, of course, Bob Kane saw The Bat Whispers.
Yes, indeed.
He probably saw it. Since he was in New York, he probably saw The Bat Whispers in its rare widescreen version, which was very unusual for the early Depression years. And
well, that's
like, that gives me an idea, you know, and of course the bat, the criminal, the bat in the play and the movie is Mary Roberts Reinhardt's idea of a dual identity character. Seems to be an okay sort in civilian guise, but he puts that bat costume on and he is the bat. And of course you got the dichotomy with the Joker.
In fact, I was going to mention the Joker. A lot of the Batman Rogues Gallery tended to be almost a nod to nightmares and horrors in their own right, because the Joker is, if I recall by Bob Kane's own account, based on the Conrad Veidt character in The Man Who Laughs.
The Man Who Laughs. I was just about to mention that. Definite influence there. And a movie that still resonates today. You will find, Brian De Palma did a movie based on the Black Dahlia murder case several years ago, And although the case is unsolvable, this film takes pains to try to suggest a solution. And the solution has a lot to do with a silent movie revival house showing The Man Who Laughs.
Interesting.
How do you explain the grotesque scarring of the victim's face in the
the
real-world murder case? So there's a lot of resonance that just won't go away. That's why the primary audience for Ted Turner's classic movie station silent thing, the primary audience looks to be in their 20s.
Yes, because there is a tremendous appeal to something going back to, you know, it's almost like the horror movie supplants or becomes the gateway to the old ghost stories and tales and such for a younger generation that grew up with a different means by which to convey these tales.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's little wonder that a younger generation is going back to films that predate them by nearly a century.
Sure. Oh yeah, I just one of a colleague's young grade school son is enchanted with Harry Houdini.
Rightfully
talk
so.
Talk about going back a century. And he was just flipped out to learn that Turner Classic Movies was running Houdini's first movie the other night.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, well, you don't have to just read about him. You can see him in action.
That's amazing.
You know, it's like, where does rock and roll begin? Oh, probably begins around the 1920s with the Jazz Age pop orchestras.
Right.
You know, each thing building
Glenn,
on the
Glenn
last.
Miller seems awfully square if you just take him on temporal value, but Glenn Miller was appealing to a teenage audience in the 40s. Yeah.
And then, of course, you take your the classic, your gothic or your classic black and white. Andy, you spoke earlier of the Universal Monsters.
Yes.
Oh, sure.
Oftentimes you're looked upon as sort of defining what we think of when we think of a monster in the classical sense, before a monster was defined by how many people he could butcher. It was more about, you know, just scaring the just gee willikers out of you. And, you know, the classic monster becomes a wonderful public domain resource.
Right.
For creators, and it's one of the things that I delight in is the level to which comics have adapted, sometimes in a very silly way, sometimes in a strangely poignant way.
Right.
The classic monster, and I mean, you know, we'll start, for example, with the vampire, which I think may arguably be one of the oldest kind of phobia, you know, the monster phobia is about one of the oldest things that go bump in the night, other than perhaps spirits and ghosts.
Yes.
You know, the vampire, and of course the most famous of their number, Count Dracula, is just ripe fruit for comic creators over the centuries.
It's ripe for the picking, and the trick is to create a character that inspires dread, but also invites a forbidden sympathy.
There you go. Perfect.
Well said,
man. But my thing, the thing that always gets me about any of these monsters, but especially vampires, is, and I don't know, I've never been in the room. Michael, you've probably been in the room, but I've never been in the room. And I would love to have been in the room when some of these were pitched, because when the thing that what you two were speaking to about, you know, when film and even to a lesser extent television kind of took root and absorbed some of that, you know, took some of that pie, took some of that horror pie away. The one thing that comics has always done, and I think we're starting to see sort of a rebirth of this in the creator-owned market, is to get really, really inventive with an idea, and in most cases, put everything that they have behind a weird idea and throw it against the wall with as much passion as they possibly can, and see if there's an audience for it.
American Horror Story, for heaven's
sake. Yeah.
You know, it's like, and it does it always work? No, but they're constantly pitching something against the wall.
Right. But things like Blade. Blade is a really intriguing character as a vampire to me. Because when you sit down and you go, okay, we want a vampire hero, great. Okay, that's fine. You know, that's been done. So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to make him a daywalker. And this is a later iteration of Blade, I believe. We're going to make him a daywalker, we're going to make him a vampire, and we're going to make sure that, you know, the sun doesn't affect him. We're going to remove that that weakness. So now he is a real superhero. And what now? Well, he can still die. Well, does he die? No. Well, why? Well, he's Blade. Like, that's the way I see that conversation going. You know, well, I mean, he's Blade. How would he die?
What good is he to us dead?
Right. And you've got, like, guys like, in my personal favorite, and if we were getting out of this episode without me talking about Mark Spector, you're all fools, started as a silver-clad centurion fighting werewolves. That was how he started. He started in Werewolf by Night with silver knuckle dusters fighting werewolves. So, you know, the ideas are amazing. So I guess my question to both of you is, what's the most inventive comic book take that you've seen on these monsters to date?
Wow.
Yeah, I'm tempted to cite Robert Kirkman.
Okay.
For, of course, The Walking Dead. Many other titles, but that's the signature title, and he's had enormous success with it, both in the comics and on television. Not so much for reinventing the George Romero-styled Walking Dead, as in taking the concept as far beyond Romero as he can get it, and of course he takes. I'd love to see George Romero guest direct an episode of The Walking Dead.
That would
be so delightful. And of course, Kirkman has acknowledged his indebtedness. He said early in the series that he wanted to create a George Romero movie that would never end. And yeah, great ideas. And of course, he's taken. What was the masterstroke in Romero? Probably a later picture called Land of the Dead, where you catch Romero reinventing his own milieu to channel John Steinbeck.
Right.
Land of the Dead is The Grapes of Wrath.
It is. No, you're absolutely correct. That had never... Wow.
and of course, you get a little more channeling there with the two characters that we call George and Lenny from Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And of course, then the... haves versus the have-nots, yeah. which is a large element in a lot of, well, Guillermo del Toro's current series, The Strain.
Yes.
Romero got there first. I mean, he had your privileged one-percenter class living in opulence, while the ordinary, you know, the Tom Joads of the world live in fear for their lives, and creates this third underclass, this second underclass of the living dead.
Yeah.
And an amazing accomplishment. And of course, Kirkman has traded very well on that. He's not simply taken the concept, he has advanced the concept.
Very admirable.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that, you know, The Walking Dead, I was aware of the comic, the precursor to this very show, more often than not, Andy would mention when we were doing a show about upcoming comics, just as an overview type of program.
Yeah.
The Walking Dead came up, I think, pretty much every week.
We were doing popular comics, and they didn't at that point in time, and even now they don't get much more popular than The Walking Dead.
I recall, your tagline was always, you know, okay, we got Walking Dead coming up, you're going to read it because you're going to read it.
That's
yeah. And I never actually heeded him on that until, you know, a year or two later. And when the show came out, it was at a time when the zombie genre it just was almost got to the point where if you wanted to make a movie, you know, if you were hurting for some money and Christmas was still 7 months away, you'd put out a zombie movie and you'd pretty much make your money back and then some, and use that to finance some other stuff that you wanted to do as a studio.
Right.
And there was just so much zombie everything. I mean, from Max Brooks's brilliant zombie survival guide and going into World War Z, which if you have not read it, you need to.
Yeah, don't rely on the movie for that.
The movie didn't do that justice, no. You don't want a PG-13 zombie movie.
Exactly. But apart from just a very few gems among the stones, it just seemed like everything was just, people were just shoveling zombies out onto the world like so much coal in a furnace. And The Walking Dead comes along, I'm thinking, you know, Andy won't shut up about the comic. I'll give this a try. So I watched the first episode, like on Netflix or something, and I immediately thought, okay, I have to stop here because I have to get my wife to watch this because she's even less excited about zombies. And I said, you have to see this because it is not only a good zombie show, what sets it apart is it's just a good show.
It's a good show, yes.
And of course, the
standard apology is, well, it's not really about the monster. Well, of course it's about the monsters, but it's also about what they inspire.
Right.
Precisely.
As opposed to beyond mere mortal terror. You know? Okay, we're going to have to either rebuild this society or convert it to something more ruthless.
Yes.
And a good conflict, a very good conflict. Of course, it helps that Frank Darabont had a hand in
the
television series.
The thing that Kirkman did, though, right? Genius thing that Kirkman did was something that no one had done yet, and that was realize that in order to make a zombie show viable, you had to really look at the zombie and realize that you remove the malevolence because they're not a malevolent creature. They are wolves. They are sharks. They are
natural born predators. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. They're a threat.
Almost like, if you will, they're almost like a deadly virus in a macroscopic form. The virus does not know its host. It does not care. It has no capacity for anything but, in the case of a virus, reproducing the species.
Propagation.
In the case of the zombie, what's driving these dead bodies that are reanimated, it's just a process of continual movement and, wherever possible, spreading, you know, perpetuating. But the brilliance in at least the television show, I'm not far enough in the comics, I don't think, where that has even become an issue, if it ever does. What I loved in the show was the concept that it wasn't the zombie that turned you into, you know, like being bitten and then wandering off and dying and being reanimated. You were already, if you died of a pneumonia or dysentery,
you're coming back.
Falling off a cliff. Yeah, there was no escape. And that makes the whole process the more frightening to those who survive long enough to realize my choice is either become this thing, even though technically I'll be gone, or to, you know, not let it have that.
Right.
An unreasoning menace.
Exactly. It's, you know, you can no more reason with the zombie than you can reason with a tsunami or a tornado.
Or mortality. That's the thing, is that what you're facing is ultimate mortality. You've realized now that there's no escape. The only escape is that if you get close enough to that light, that your friend on the left is going to stick a knife in your head, and that's the only way you're getting out. You know, that's the only way you're not coming back, which is horrifying. That is, that to know that you cannot, I mean, because, you know, human culture is based on the idea that there's a cycle and we get to pass peacefully if we can help, if we can, you know, and if we don't, how many stories have been written about, you know, poltergeists, malevolent spirits that come back because they have unfinished business? We don't get that luxury in the world of The Walking Dead anymore. That has been taken from us.
And also, in a way, it's almost like nature itself defiling the body.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, there is a cultural significance to, you know, dragging the body off the battlefield so your enemy doesn't defile it.
Mm-hmm.
But when the simple passing is nearly instantaneous defilement by nature itself, then,
yeah,
and you come across the remains of someone, or you know, to me the most brilliant use of that genre is when a living person is confronted with the reanimated remains of a child.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Because the psychology is even more powerful.
And of course, that's the linchpin of Romero's first film.
Exactly.
Not only a child, but your child.
Or much like in the one of the stories in Brooks's World War Z, that would have been very difficult to translate on film, but where the Russian troops are confronted with a child and being unable to get around the psychology of the fact that this is no longer a human being. So.
See, my favorite in comics that has been translated into a movie, and I felt it did the job quite well, were the vampires from 30 Days of Night.
Oh, 30 Days of Night, yeah.
Oh, very good.
Because we're talking about the exact opposite of Kirkman's Walking Dead. When we're talking about Niles' 30 Days of Night, we're talking about thinking genius level apex predators, you know, that find the perfect hunting ground, and mm-hmm. and you know, the place where it's night for a month and there's no sunlight, and you know, you're very isolated. They brought the isolation of a John Carpenter's Thing, and you know, the horror, you know, the foreboding horror of a Dracula, and smashed them together on a grand scale, you know, smash those atoms together, and you get this nuclear fusion of just paranoia and fear and abject terror when you're being hunted. And again, we see children, because there's nothing more horrifying than a child monster. You know, but we see child monsters in this with, you know, the shark teeth, because they did the vampires not with the two sexy fangs, you know, they did mm-hmm. the shark teeth. And for me, that movie hit on a lot of chords, because and the comic actually.
Because their vampires aren't the, you know, human-sized, human-looking vampire bat from Mexico that's going to come poke a little hole in you and just lap your blood up at its leisure until it gets full and flaps away. These are going to just rend your flesh apart and bathe in the blood that's pouring out. It's EC horror all over again.
It really is. And when I cracked that book the first time, I was an adult. You know, this was probably, I can't remember, it had to be about 10 years ago. I remember being scared of horror comics when I was very young, you know, when I was mm-hmm. probably 6 or 7. But I hadn't been scared of a comic book. I hadn't wanted to go turn on another light when I was reading a comic until I read 30 Days of Night. And then I couldn't stop raving about it. I'm like, everybody needs to get this book and read it. And it was...
Oh, sure. You run across a book like that ever so often. Wonderful series that DC did called The New Frontier.
Yes.
Astonishing. Darwin Cook, was it not?
It was.
Yes, indeed.
Splendid piece of work, and it took me a while to even give it a try, but then a good friend in the business says, "You got to read this." I said, "Well," and sure enough, that sort of thing, that's where you have not only the intelligence in the writing, but also the respect for the reader's intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's that sort of presupposition that your reader has a brain in their head.
Yeah, it's like it, which is which is the way we used to work in the newspaper business before the dumb it down philosophy took over. Like, just assume your reader is smarter than you, and they will appreciate the compliment.
That's great. I love it.
That is brilliantly voiced.
Well, it's like Cole's constant screaming into the void when it comes to superhero movies and TV shows, where we don't need another Batman origin or Spider-Man origin movie. We all know. Everyone knows now. Just stop.
Go out into the vast wastelands and find, you know, indigenous peoples. If you drew a Spider-Man mask in the snow, it would immediately say in their language, Peter Parker.
Yeah.
And they just know this as part of the zeitgeist because they have been, you know, even if they've never seen a comic book, they can identify and probably tell you in some fashion the origin of Spider-Man. We don't need to have it parroted back to us again.
Right.
Well, the comic books as a class, and this is where books like 30 Days of Night, The Walking Dead, Cadillacs and Dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. That was such a good series.
Where books like this are so valuable is that they remind us of how much fun the creators seemed to be having on, like, Marvel before it knew it was Marvel.
Right.
Well, yes, because, to cite another book in that class is Saga, which Andrew had
so
been beating me to read. I found the first volume, the collected volume, poured through that, and thankfully my friend Steve brought me 2 through 5, which I was nearing the end of 5 saying, this can't be it, because I, for some reason, had it in my mind it was just going to be 5 volumes and we're done, and I thought, oh, this is going to be so disappointing if they're barreling up to a conclusion. No, they're not. Oh, great. Now I've got to find volume 6.
Oh, yeah, that was the, you know, I mean, back in a day when Julius Schwartz was not just dispensing entertainment, he was playing with his readers.
Right.
When he was reinventing the costumed hero franchises right and left at DC Comics in the 50s and early 60s. It's like, yeah, let's create the kind of books that we want to read, and if we please ourselves, chances are good that we'll please someone else.
And a lot of them at that. And that brings me to the kind of very smart storytelling. And in the monster genre was a character that began as a horror monster, the tortured soul trapped in a, kind of like the it was really draws heavily from the old concept of a werewolf or other creatures that are intrinsically human, your Jekyll and Hyde, if you will, but are then trapped in a form that brings terror and or often more often than not is a terror, and after a long absence. Since I can't find a monster corollary in Watchmen, I will invoke Alan Moore with his run on Swamp Thing.
I was waiting for it. There it is.
Yeah,
all right.
Oh, yeah.
Which
inevitable.
Basically picked up where the series was abandoned. And then said, everything you've ever read still works. This is the brilliance of Alan Moore here, is everything that preceded it was not washed away. This was not a John Byrne Man of Steel that effectively erases history. Starts over from scratch. This suggests everything you've ever read still works.
Yeah.
But here's why it can still work and be dead wrong.
Right.
And that was in reinventing the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
Not in reinventing the story of the beast. You didn't need, except in little snippets, to rehash Alec Holland's transformation into the Swamp Thing. You only needed enough to know enough about that, if you didn't already know, to realize that this was never Alec Holland in the first
place. It was like a Rashomon, the same story from a different vantage.
Precisely. And what I love about where Moore took that is once you get the character reinvented, one of the first things he does is go on this sort of cross-country purge of all of the boogeymen.
Right.
In fact, one of the characters is effectively the boogeyman, who is this hyper-irradiated, this individual who for some reason is completely immune or largely immune to the fact that he's slowly being eaten away by radiation.
Oh, the nuke face concept.
Yes, nuke face, yes. That's right. And what I loved about that is it took all of the elements of gothic horror and gave them to a modern horror icon.
Oh yeah, and that's pretty much the iconic is a terribly abused word, but when you see, you know it when you see it, and of course that particular continuity also spoke very well to literalize the addiction of modern society to nuclear energy.
Yes.
Let's make the atomic fission obsession a literal addiction.
Yes, because as I recall, he was constantly in search of more of the very thing that created him.
Yeah.
He was literally drawn to it. Yeah, like an alcoholic to a bar.
There.
And then was completely. It was almost like a zombie you could talk to, because he was completely oblivious to the harm he was causing. The brilliant opening of that story is him telling this long, drawn-out tale, and then you finally see that his audience is dead and melting from exposure. And he just wanders off in disgust because his companion here is ignoring him. It's like, well, kind of dead.
Well, everything Alan Moore writes has the taste of gothic horror to it.
Absolutely.
Even his humor is of the, you can tell this guy's been studying up on his Gay and Wilson and Charles Adams. And of course the monstrous element in Watchmen is not only self-evident at the climax, but. What kind of social conditions turned these people into wanting to be vigilantes?
Right.
Or needing to be.
Yes, especially in Rorschach's case. Where he's
definitely that. And it's like, okay, I can't repair the damage that has been done me, but I can perhaps purge the element that followed it.
Exactly. He sort of takes it upon himself to kind of be the one lancing the boil on the surface of humanity as far as he's concerned.
And of course Moore, he tends to be arch and poetic,
right?
Which I personally like. A lot of people find that just a little bit too, look, Ma, I'm writing.
Right. But, insistent is the
word.
By
golly, he is writing, and it's his almost the throwaway lines. Where, for example, the character Rorschach walks into a bar. Sounds like a setup for a joke. And the bartender greets him with a nervous laugh and says, "Please don't kill anybody."
Yes, indeed.
It's like, whoa, that sticks.
Yeah,
and in fact, there's another almost a very similar kind of tale in that same arc, if I'm not mistaken, in Swamp Thing, where. You had the character who was a mass murderer,
mm-hmm.
who vividly, all he remembers of his victims is their eyes, but you don't realize when he's telling tales about, you know, this woman in Chattanooga or this guy that he met at a train station and the effect that their eyes, he had, you know, they had those kind of eyes that, you know, were just blue enough. And then you realize through the course of the story and him, when justice is finally dispensed, as it were, if I recall, it has been a long time since I read that, and now I'm inspired to go back and pull all those. But that's the other thing, that the true gothic horror is sort of weaving your villain, you know, having your villain sort of hiding somewhere in the background. Your true monsters don't show themselves.
Right.
It's lurking in plain sight. And we don't always see them coming in a very overt way. They're not always dressed in hockey masks.
Well, the scariest monsters never are.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Vincent Price seldom wore extravagant makeups.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think the only exception to the rule would be Dr. Fibes.
And a good reason for that exception. Yeah. Yeah, that's... just an amazing, little heritage. But yeah, we keep finding out all these new things about old things. It's current book we're just waiting on from IDW is basically the first sustained horror comics series in a nice hardcover collection.
Wow.
Called The Ghosts and Girls of Fiction House.
That's amazing.
And that, of course, that originated in one of these anthology comics in the 40s called Jumbo Comics.
Huh.
Why did they call it Jumbo? Because it was jumbo. It was bigger than most because it had originated in England, and they did the American editions. This was the Iger shop. In a jumbo size, which eventually shrunk to conventional dimensions. And that was this started out as a showcase for Will Eisner, Hawk of the Seas, collaborative jungle series called Sheena.
Ah, yeah.
Still well known today. Of course, Sheena became the anchoring feature in Jumbo Comics, but there was also an espionage series in the same title, there were aviation series, westerns, piracy, what have you. But the one that Craig Yeo and I have been concentrating on is called Ghost Gallery. And it's 10 years before Tales from the Crypt.
Oh, my. Yes.
Wow.
And of course, you get to going through the many, many Ghost Gallery stories we've done. We've kind of cherry-picked the series to get the first book out. And you find artists like Al Feldstein.
Really?
Jack Kamen. You know, signature artists of the of the EC horror books. And it's like, I recognize that style, and even though it's not signed, I know who it is. And of course, then there's many artists who became more prominent, not necessarily famous. Matt Baker.
Okay.
Who's known for his what they call good girl art. Bob Webb, who was the principal layout artist on Sheena, but usually turned the inking over to other hands. Al Feldstein told me not too long before he died that he always enjoyed getting Bob's Sheena pencils to ink because Webb would draw Sheena in the hole together. And it was Feldstein's job to apply the leopard skin wardrobe.
So he had to come in and literally put the fig leaf on the statue, as it were.
Exactly, exactly. And, of course, Webb seldom got a byline in all his long career. Exceptions would be, okay, you want to talk about prototypical monster comics? Webb did the Classics Illustrated Frankenstein.
Wow. Hey.
Which holds up beautifully today. And by golly, he got a byline.
That's awesome. Oh, man.
I'm just in awe.
I can't. I would love to sit here all night. I would. But unfortunately, we can't. And
well, timing is everything.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And in fact, I want to point out before we do have to close, there was, since we are talking about monsters and comics, there was I didn't remember the publisher. It was actually, of all things, Monster Comics. Which in 1992, I had the good fortune to stumble on all of the four issues, adapted the film Freaks.
Oh, that was Fantagraphics.
Oh, okay. I guess it was the
Monster Comics. Monster Comics was Fantagraphics.
Ah, very
wow.
good. Yeah,
and
the Tom Brown film from 32.
The artist's name escapes me, but the adaptation was written by Jim Woodring.
Let's see if this has. This may actually have. The artist's name here.
That's a lovely piece of work. I haven't
F.
seen
Solano
it in years.
Lopez. Yes.
Yes.
If you have ever seen the film, the actual 1932 film Freaks, which I think if anyone who purports to love classic horror needs to see this because it messes with your head in an even bigger way than American Horror Story Freak Show may have.
Oh, well, yes.
Because they couldn't fake much of anybody.
Right.
And what this series does is, I would recommend if you seek out the comic, see the film first, and then you can see how the comic takes that, which is a rather short film, if I remember, and extrapolates and gives you a lot more of the society that exists within the freaks of the circus, who are kind of cloistered away in their own sort of, you know, they're part of the circus, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is that sort of society of adversity writ large all over this. And it's very brilliantly, because it's not just a direct adaptation, it brings you even more character than the film did. And the film treated its subject matter in their private lives rather remarkably well for its day.
And yes, there were mixed feelings within the society of freaks who played in the movie. I spent quite a bit of time out in Los Angeles visiting with Angelo Rosito, the dwarf actor, who is one of the prominent characters in Freaks. The first time I brought the topic up, he spit on the ground and...
Wow.
Oh, don't talk to me about that picture. Angelo ran a newsstand in Hollywood, a street corner newsstand.
Oh, wow.
And he also worked in the movies, you know, but his main job was running the newsstand. That's why he appears as a news dealer in some films, like Daughter of Horror, for example. But he appeared, let me see, there's a good shot. Have you ever seen the Basement Tapes LP set by Bob Dylan and the Band?
Now, music is our previous guest, perfect.
I believe I've seen it.
There's a gatefold cover on the LP version, and Angelo is among the characters pictured in that Dylan album. But he later came around to where he would speak favorably of Freaks. I last spoke with Angelo not long before he died, which would have been in the early 90s. He had already made Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And he had pretty well come around to think, yeah, maybe that movie did us some good after all.
Wow,
that is amazing. So yeah, if you do get a chance, check out both the film and the comic, because they do go very much hand in glove. And that was one I did not want to get away from Monsters without mentioning, because that is a film that is it's accidentally more frightening, just by virtue of the fact that your mind has a hard time dealing with the fact that absolutely anyone who is not quote-unquote normal in this film, almost without exception, that's how they live their life every day, or at least
that's the genuine article. I had a cousin in the carnival racket, quite a bit older than I was, but every year when the stock show would come to town, he'd show up with his freak show. And I had backstage privileges, got to know a lot of the freaks. And there is no normal. Normal is where you feel most comfortably at home.
Right.
Absolutely. And this, I have to say, is one of the things we talk about on the show in closing is, especially when we get really serious, because we don't always do that on the show.
Yeah, no, certainly not.
Sometimes we just a couple of hacks yakking away about comics, but one of the things that I really like about this is throughout the course of this, because Andrew and I, our age difference, our experience with comics is so vastly different, we bring different things to the table, but I always like to feel like at the end of the day, once we've wrapped all these things up, hopefully we've inspired people, mentioned something you've never heard of, inspired you to check out something new, and I have never been as inspired to go check out like 100 things.
Right, right.
As I am right now. And this is just like within an hour, I'm already like, oh my God, what else do I need to look at?
We're 155 hours deep of this, Cole. We're 155 hours deep of this. And I am more inspired to go find these comics than I think I've ever been.
Oh, it's just been amazing. So I did have to point that out because we do like to feel like we're educating and inspiring whenever possible. And this has been the most educational and inspired I've been, or educated and inspired, in the entire runs thus far.
I agree.
We also have the advantage that most of these books are more readily available today than they ever have been.
Yeah,
very true.
And at generally at reasonable prices. Those good old days of running down to the corner drugstore and picking up the new comic books is long past. I mean, you'll never smell that fresh ink again. But the nice anthology editions, widespread, mostly reasonably priced. You catch half-price books on a good day, and they'll have a whole bunch of brand-new classic horror comics anthologies right there for the taking.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, let's wrap this up. Let's plug this up. Michael Price, you are a godsend. Thank you so much for coming on.
And tell us quickly some of the projects, because I had the benefit of meeting you not too long ago and hearing about some of the fascinating things that you're up to.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the latest book out is an anthology that runs parallel to the Fiction House project. It's not duplicating, but a nice overlap. The book, the new book is called The Gripes of Wraith.
Nice.
Which is a collection of other ghost gallery stories using a different restoration process. We restore pages in different ways. Many approaches. That Gripes of Wraith that just hit Amazon this week is a continuation of a series I call Comics from the Gone World.
That's great.
And just today, well, outside of the music business, earlier today I sent the eighth volume of Forgotten Horrors, the movie history series, off to the printers. So that'll be coming out probably within the week.
That's amazing. And what else?
It's a good timing there if you're listening to the show on Friday or afterward. Go look into that because that sounds incredible in its own right.
And amazing stuff.
What else can people find you in? What else have you done? What else have you lovingly applied your name to that people can go pick up now?
Well, the Forgotten Horrors series is the bestseller, I guess.
Okay.
We finally determined that Forgotten Horrors is the longest-running film genre study franchise in commercial publishing. It's been, I think the first book came out in 1979. It's been revised and expanded two or three times, and now we're up to, we have 9 volumes out and a few spin-offs. Just keyword Michael H. Price at Amazon, and that'll pretty well tell you most of the things going on.
That's great.
And I do have a few namesakes. There's another Michael H. Price who writes books about mathematics, which is like, no, different guy. The music business, a lot of new CDs in print. We've been remastering the catalog of LPs lately to get them available to a new audience. I won't do MP3 downloads because of the loss in sound quality, but we do keep a pretty good run of CD titles out.
And you're a podcaster in your own right, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, the Forgotten Horrors podcast.
Yes, and I'm always... I always feel, and I said this before, but I always feel blessed when another podcaster comes on our show because I know how valuable that time is. You know, we know what goes into this sickness that we have for sitting and talking.
Well, that and then to have a podcaster author,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you don't amass that sort of knowledge and then keep it to yourself.
Yeah, that's very true.
You know, I mean, what's the great value of publishing? Well, it's the privilege of inflicting your crackpot opinions on large groups of people. hey, nice work if you can get it.
That's right. Cole, why don't you plug us up here?
Well, very good.
On our end.
With if we can get ourselves speaking coherently again, we'll be back here with the More Hey Kids Comics next week through the auspices, if you will, of the Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com, and where you can find this show, The Rant Corpette, with myself and Eddie Medina talking up the Star Wars. And then you have the Convention Awareness Project Texas, which is my loving side project that I'm always very deeply touched when people tell me how invaluable that is. It's been a labor of love for 3 years now, and I'm silly for conventions. I love we have so many in Texas. So go to cap-tx.info if you want to keep on top of the entire convention schedule all year long. 2016 listings are slowly being added, so
there you
look
go.
For that. And
Deep Ellum.
That, I'm
Deep Ellum.
I said jcumail@yahoo.com if you're so inclined, and please do write. And look for Eddie and I on the Rant Corpette Live on deepellumonair.com out of the One Eye Joe Studios in Dallas, Texas. And with that, I think I'll shut up for a while.
All right. Yeah, I don't even want to talk right now. Thank you all for listening. I hope that you guys found this as enlightening and impassioning as I know Cole and I did. Michael, again, thank you for joining us. I am ashamed to say it. Next week begins Cole and I's yearly adventure into the world of our other passion, which is toys and collectibles, coming up on the holiday season. So join us next week for the beginning of, I believe, the beginning of Toylandia.
It is. We're doing Toylandia Part 1. I have not yet titled the 5 issues of the arc, but I assure you they will be that same sort of ridiculous width that I apply to all of
them. Yeah, we're going to definitely get back to dick jokes next week. I was way too wrapped and reserved this week to go off the reservation, but next week all bets are off, ladies and gentlemen. So thank you all for listening. Thank you for all the time that you've spent, the 155 hours that you've allowed us to, like was so eloquently said earlier, spout our crackpot ideas into your brains. Michael, do you have any parting words? You've been so eloquent tonight. I feel like I should throw it to you for our send-off.
Well, just I just encourage everyone to get out there and grab all the funny books they can get their hands on and figure out what this medium's got to say.
There you go. Thank you guys so much. Join us next week for another edition of Hey Kids Comics.
Thanks so much.
You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Mm-hmm. Must be the season of the witch. Must be looking.